Hello and welcome to the podcast Sensory Success Stories, a podcast by the European Sensory Network, ESN. In it, we will talk about recent trends, challenging questions, and surprising results in the area of sensory and consumer science. I'm your host, Fabienne Hüben. Our guest today is Janice Wang from the University of Copenhagen, and we will talk about chemosensory creativity. Welcome, Janice, to the podcast. Please, could you introduce yourself and your research?
Sure. Thank you, Fabienne, for the opportunity. My name is Janice Wang. I am an associate professor at the Department of Food Science at the University of Copenhagen. I'm an associate professor of consumer behavior, which might mean a lot of things to different people. In general, I work with flavor perception, drivers of consumer purchase and also eating behavior. And I tend to work with a lot of contextual cues and multisensory cues.
And where are you coming from? I think you didn't study food science or chemistry. What is your background?
No, I'm a very strange person. Because my background was originally computer science and human-computer interaction. And then I did my PhD in experimental psychology with Charles Spence in Oxford. And because I was studying music and taste interactions, that got me into this whole field of multisensory flavor perception. And that took me to the departments of food science. So I've come on this very, maybe a little bit strange interdisciplinary journey.
Let's get to the first question. Maybe this has something to do with actually where you're coming from, because you're not the classical food scientist. Why did you become interested in creativity and food or chemosensory creativity in the first place?
So the really easy answer is that I was interested in both sides and I put them together. So I have a history of working with flavor, obviously. So that part is maybe a bit more obvious. And I've always liked food and wine as well. The creativity part, there were two reasons. One is that I had hired a postdoc at the time who came from neuroscience looking at music and creativity. Patricia was very interested in creativity, and that kind of got the whole lab thinking about creativity. And the second reason for creativity is that independently of my postdoc, in 2022, I was working 50% of the time for the Center for Hybrid Intelligence at Aarhus University. And there I was working with something completely not food related. I was working with citizen science games that can be used to do like psychological assessment, cognitive assessment. And one of the games I was working a lot with was a creativity game. So I was actually doing quite a bit of work with quote unquote classical creativity assessment, classical in the sense that it was looking at semantics, it was looking at vision, it was very traditional methods of assessing creativity, even though we were putting it in a digital game and there were it was very, you know, cutting edge. So, you know, on the one side, I was at the Department of Management working with creativity assessment. On the other hand, I was in the Department of Food Science looking at flavor perception. So it was pretty obvious. I mean, in a way, it's how, you know, people get creative ideas is that you take two things and you combine them together. So that's exactly what I did. I became interested in chemosensory creativity.
And I actually got a definition of creativity from one of your slides that you showed at ECRO, the European Chemoreception Research Organization meeting. And it says, to answer the question, what is creativity? The ability to generate something novel, unpredictable or surprising, unusual and meaningful. Do you actually have a different, maybe more personal definition? Or do you totally agree with this definition?
So I should say that people, I mean, the when I say people, I mean the field of creativity researchers. It's quite maybe controversial, it's a strong word, but I don't think there's wide agreement on one particular definition of creativity. That definition, which I included in the workshop slide, I got from the book The Neuroscience of Creativity. It's a definition that I quite like. That's why I included it. Because it has, I think it does a good job of capturing different elements of creativity. Because I think usually when we talk about creativity, people think about the novelty factor. Oh, it's new. I think what is often missing from that definition is also the meaningful part. You know, is it functional? Is it utilitarian? Because a lot of ideas can be creative. Maybe they're new, maybe they're unusual, but they're not necessarily useful. And for me, so here comes the personal mm-hmm. interpretation part. I think a truly creative idea has to be both novel and be very good at solving whatever issue or the question you have at hand. So that like functionality part is super mm-hmm. important.
But that would leave out artists yeah. like Van Gogh or modern performance artists, where many people question, maybe back then was it meaningful or today is it meaningful? What do you say to that?
So this, you just asked a really good question into the nature of creativity assessment, in which case this is, you know, are you assessing the artist? Are you assessing their mental process, or are mm-hmm. you assessing the artwork? Because when it comes to assessing the artwork, it very much depends on who is doing the judgment. So it's possible that maybe back in their day, like a Van Gogh, people didn't think was meaningful or useful. Maybe it was novel. Whereas today it's, you know, mm-hmm. one of the classics. So I think the definition of utility also depends on the beliefs and also the, let's say, the mm-hmm. expertise mm-hmm. of the person doing the assessment. So I think it's a bit difficult to say objectively whether something mm-hmm. is creative, because it depends. Maybe it's similar to beauty. I don't want to start okay. discussing
it's a big topic. It gets really into the area of philosophy and aesthetics. Let's get back to the science. How can we measure creativity? And do you have an example of a classical test?
Yes. So like I mentioned, when we talk about creativity, we have to be clear about what exactly is it that we're measuring. Because like I said, it could be based on the creation, so an mm-hmm. artwork or a dish or a perfume. It could be a personality trait. This is like something about a person. It could also be about the creative mm-hmm. thought process. And often this thought process is linked to something called creative potential. Or because it's one thing to actually, you know, like an artist, you can actively create pieces of art. It's also possible that you have this creative potential inside that you just haven't mm-hmm. manifested it in artworks. So there are many different ways of assessing creativity. So in like the research that I have been looking into, we were focused on this idea of creative thinking. So this is evaluating the creative thought process. And I like this way of measuring creativity, because it's relevant for everybody. It's not that you have to be able to produce incredibly creative products, because often in order to create a product, you need some also expertise and some skill. So it's a bit difficult to divorce the ability, the capability from the creative thought. And classically, a lot of psychometrics tests was measuring what's so-called creativity potential, because it's, the tests themselves are not so difficult, shall we say. You don't need, you're not supposed to need a lot of skill, let's put it that way. But there are ways of measuring creative thinking. And you were asking about some, say, typical tests of creative thinking. In general, at least according to one school of thought, creative thinking can be broken down into two different categories, convergent thinking and divergent thinking. So CT or DT, maybe what's more commonly known are the divergent thinking tasks, because these are maybe the most intuitive version. When I talk about divergent thinking, it's like how many different ideas can you come up with? So in research, we often use something called the AUT or alternative uses task. And this is a semantic task where the prompt is something like, come up with as many creative uses for a blank as possible. The blank can be a brick, an umbrella, a fork, a tire. There are actually papers on recommendations for which prompt might be better. But the general idea is that these tests should be quite cultural agnostic as much as possible. So the prompts are usually things like, you know, cups or forks, or maybe forks is not a good umbrella. Things that are very agnostic and people can come up with uses. Another visually based test is the Torrance test of creative thinking. In that case, it's a picture. So you can, for example, start with a circle, and then people have to make a drawing to come, like, to add on top of the circle or a square. So this is like a drawing test, which is often given to children, for example, because, you know, they don't need to have language mastery. And just to touch on the point of maybe some drawbacks with these traditional tests, the alternative uses task, the one where you have to come up with as many creative uses, that test depends a little bit on like language proficiency. How comfortable do you feel with the language to be able to type? Similarly, with the Torrance test of creative thinking, with the drawing task, it still matters how good you are at drawing to be able to convey your ideas clearly.
I just did a short Google search. The first test that is coming up when you ask for creativity testing is a divergent association task, where you are asked to come up with 10 words. And they should be as different from each other as possible. So I did that. Possible. I had a very high score, was very happy. But 10 minutes later, I did it again, and it was much lower. So that's my question. How reliable and standardized are these tests?
That is a really good question. So the divergent association test you mentioned is one of the, I think it's very trendy nowadays to, it's one of these upcoming tests. I think it's trendy nowadays because it's becoming easier to score. And we can talk about that later in terms of how it can be automatically scored. It's very funny. So I will say two things. The first thing I will say is that the tests I mentioned, like the AUT and the Torrance test, these tests have been used for many years. So in a way, they're standardized in the sense that many people have accepted to use them for creativity testing. I would have to check the literature on test-retest reliability, because I'm sure there's a variance. And this takes me to the second thing I want to say, which is I wrote a whole review paper on how eating might make us more creative. And all the studies mentioned in that paper is basically showing how context can change creativity test behavior. So in a way, this my review paper kind of goes against the idea that these tests should be very objective and very reliable. If we can see that, for example, being in a different room or having a different color background or listening to different music can really change your score on these tests. So I think maybe the best way to think about this is that these are tests of creative thought process. And our thought process might be, say, malleable to different contexts. It's maybe similar to a memory test. If I give you a memory test in the morning when you're fresh versus after a long day of work when you're very tired, I am sure that your scores would be different.
But it's also a good thing. That means you can change and influence your creativity with the right context.
Yes, yes. And maybe with training, your, you know, scores might improve. Should certainly for memory tests, right? If you train, or at least if you train on specifically how to tests you, you can improve. I'm just trying to quickly think whether I'm aware of any studies that show a long-term effect of training on this kind of general divergent thinking. And I'm not sure, actually.
would be an interesting topic to do more research.
Yes, there are a lot of developmental tests, for example, to see how children will develop over time, and that can make sense. But you know, in terms of how adults will develop and change over time, I don't think people have looked at that. Maybe one area, workplace creativity, a very popular topic nowadays, because seeing as important that workers should be creative. So I am pretty sure there should be intervention studies looking at how specific methods or workshops might increase worker creativity. Now, of course, how those kind of creative thinking is measured, I'm not sure. And also one slightly controversial area of research is there is not so much evidence linking performance on creative potential tests with actual, say, workplace creative activity. So this is another area of research. So there's a lot of open questions.
And most of what has been written and researched in the area of creativity is about vision, it's about hearing, but not so much in the area of chemosensory. So how come people have seemed to have forgotten about this creativity in the area of smelling or tasting and food?
And I should say there's not even so much on hearing.
Okay. Mostly
it's
vision.
Mostly vision and semantics, so some sort of language test. I think there are two reasons. One reason is probably that it's easier to score the test if it's visual or if it's text-based. We are also used to having tests that are either language-based or picture-based. And I think another reason is probably similar to the reason why most tests are text-based or vision-based. I think people don't think about cognition dealing with smell and taste. It's just an overlooked area. A few years ago at ECRO, I was part of a workshop that was called Mind the Gap, What Happened to Creative Cognition in the olfaction. It's just like people, I mean, I think now there is more research looking at the link to, you know, memory and smell. But compared to the other senses, it's just really overlooked. So I think it's just maybe in general, the kind of people who study creativity don't tend to think about the other senses. Even coming from experimental psychology, you know, I was coming from a lab called the Cross-Model Research Lab. And there I would say, when people think about cross-model psychology, people think about audiovisual interactions, maybe sometimes touch. And that's already quite rare. Almost zero on smell and touch. Smell and taste. But maybe it's also because in an experimental setting, it's very easy to present pictures. It's quite easy to present sound. It's not so easy to present smells and tastes. People don't necessarily have an olfactometer or a gustometer. And even there, you will be very limited in how much you can present. So I think, yes, it's inherent challenges, like practically, and both, I think there's a bias in, you know, which senses seem to matter more. And also it may be it's more difficult to assess if it's.
You tried to bridge the gap, and at the last ECRO workshop about chemosensory creativity, you invited participants to invent a creativity assessment. You wanted it to be easy to administer, something that could be tested online. Did the participants come up with any interesting tests, or is it really so difficult that you need months and years to think about it?
I think it depends. So I should say that, unfortunately, we didn't have enough time for people to actually sit down and have this brainstorming session. I would love to do this. Maybe the next ESN meeting could be a good place for this. But I wanted to present the design constraints. We were showcasing some prototypes that we had come up with for measuring creativity. But before we presented our prototypes, we thought it was important to outline the frame in which we want to present this. Easy to administer is very important if you want to test lots of people. For example, an online test. Of course, if it's an online test, then you can't really not yet present actual smells and tastes, which presents its own difficulties. And another very key criteria is that creativity assessments, they should be easy to score. One of the drawbacks of traditional creativity testing is that you needed to have human judges. And often these human judges needed to be trained. So it's very resource intensive. You have to train them. Humans are slow. If you want to test a lot of people very quickly, it's very difficult and very time consuming. In the last 10 years or so, the AUT, the Alternative Uses Task, that has become more popular because people developed ways to use natural language processing techniques to automatically score them. So this was the kind of the background thinking. Can we have something that can be widespread to a lot of people and as much as possible having it be automatically scored?
But it should be possible, or?
We're still working on that. During the workshop we had at ECRO, so we had four different activities. Two of the activities involved people doing these kind of creative thinking assessment tasks. And then two of the activities involved making a product-based creativity assessment. So we had a wine and cheese pairing task and a chocolate tasting task. So I should say this workshop was sold out and really popular. Probably because anytime you go to a conference workshop and they serve wine and cheese and chocolates, it's more, say, interactive than sitting there for 2 hours listening to five people give talks.
At the ECRO workshop, you also came up with a task for participants where you asked them to come up with as many creative flavor pairings as possible for ice cream involving the starting flavor chocolate. So you ask them, try to think about original flavor pairings that would taste good together in a chocolate ice cream. And they had 2 minutes. An example would be chocolate and bacon, chocolate and lavender. Do you remember some of the answers of the participants?
So this was the prototype assessment that I had developed, very much inspired by the alternative uses task, the AUT. Because, for example, that test is usually administered in 2 minutes. So here's the 2 minute time limit. I try to touch on both the divergent thinking and the convergent thinking part, because the question asks for original flavors, that's divergent thinking, but it has to taste good together. Mm-hmm. So that's the convergent. Mm-hmm. So it's like you spread it out, but then you also limit. I didn't hear about so many flavors, to be honest, because what we had people do after this 2 minute task is, as a group, talk about how they might make a creativity score. So people ended up discussing, how you might calculate metrics for creativity rather than sharing their most creative flavors. But I can tell you that in the past, I have also done this once for a pub quiz I did for the Center for Hybrid Intelligence group. And the most creative flavor that was rated by the group was chocolate and roast pork.
Like chocolate and roast pork. Yeah, I can see that. I mean, in Mexico, they also use chocolate sauce on meat. So it's not so totally out of the world.
And one of the participants brought up a really good question, which is involving the starting flavor chocolate. But what kind of chocolate am I talking about? Is it dark? Is it milk? Is it white? That would be very different. And I realized that I would have to revise this to make it slightly more explicit. So yeah, if it's dark spiced chocolate with roast pork, that might work.
I can see a group of people actually in a kitchen with ice cream and different other kinds of foods, and not only writing down what they would think would taste good, but preparing it, and then afterwards you can taste it. Then you have the meaningful or the tasty part in the creativity.
This is something I would love to do. So I would love to do a physical, real-life version of this. It might be a little bit easier to change the prompt, so it's not make as many flavors as possible, but if we can say in 2 minutes, make the most, and then we can have people go around and actually taste.
Okay, I would love to be part of that workshop.
Maybe chocolate ice cream could be difficult, but like a chocolate fudge, you know, one of when I made this prototype assessment, we actually, there were four questions with four different starting foods and four flavors. One of them was the strawberry smoothie. So I think this could maybe be easier to do if we say strawberry plus X smoothie, and we can have people actually make these smoothies and have people taste them. So yeah, I would love to do a physical version of this at some point. One of the things that's quite difficult, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, is how would you automatically score this task?
Before we get into that, I would also like to mention that you asked ChatGPT to answer your question of coming up with these kind of flavor pairings with chocolate ice cream. Yes. And I was surprised what ChatGPT came up with, because I really like that. For example, maple bacon chocolate symphony or cucumber mint chocolate chill. So is artificial intelligence or ChatGPT as good or better than us in terms of food creativity?
This is a really interesting question, because you have to remember, we don't even have a metric for measuring creativity yet. So this is, maybe this is a bit controversial, because there are different, let's say, schools of thought regarding what is creativity. You know, is creativity just the ability to put together combinations? In this case, flavors, in other case, words. It's kind of like, yes, monkeys, you know, monkeys on a typewriter can potentially type Shakespeare. But then does that mean the monkeys are necessarily more creative than humans? I think that machine learning can help people come up with inspiration and creative ideas. Like this cucumber mint chocolate thing you mentioned. I've never thought about that before, but now I'm like, oh yeah, it could totally work. Like dark chocolate sorbets, kind of very bitter, refreshing, yeah. But I don't necessarily think what the AI is doing is creativity, per se. It's, in a way, randomly putting together flavor combinations. Of course, I think with ChatGPT, it's a bit more sophisticated. So it can find flavor combinations that, you know, might be highly unusual, but could have something in common. That's why they did cucumber and the mint. So I think it can be a tool to help us. But, you know, knock on wood, it's not going to completely replace people in terms of creativity. It will become increasingly helpful. So this is actually a very good question, because when I was working for the Center for Hybrid Intelligence, the whole goal of the center is to study how humans and AI can work together. At this point, what I have to think about is, what can the human contribute that machines can't? And I think, and I have to really qualify this by saying this is my own opinion, I think what humans are good at that machines can't do yet is, when I read a description like maple, bacon, chocolate symphony, I can imagine how it tastes like, and I can kind of comment on that imagined flavor experience. Like, I can think about how good it might taste, or how good other people might think it tastes. And I think this kind of translation from text to like mental imagery and description and making an evaluation, I don't think machines can do that.
Yet.
Yeah.
I just heard a talk at the last ESN meeting where not only can artificial intelligence help to recruit participants and analyze the data when they, for example, evaluate food, but they actually can also now make synthetic people who give the answer. So you don't really need real participants anymore. But just because of huge databases, you can fake human experience and sensory reactions. So I think in this field, there's so much going on that, we always have to say yet.
Yes, and also with machine learning, it's, you know, your algorithms are only as good as the data you put in. So when you have synthetic participants, okay, which data are you training on? are you targeting your products only to a particular group? You know, this is one of the issues with ChatGPT, is that it has a very, like white North American European centric perspective, which is interesting, but it's not culturally appropriate. It's always the balance of, you know, maybe that's why we say yet, because you've, in the ideal world, if you could get all the data from everybody and train it, yes, you could get something that could be more appropriate. So back to your ChatGPT example comment, you know, when I made the prompt for it, I did say that people from North America would find. So I had to, you know, prompt engineering, I had to make it a bit more specific.
You were mentioning how difficult it is to find maybe an automatic way to rate chemosensory creativity. Is there anything on the horizon how to do that? Do we have ideas, or are other people thinking in this direction?
I'm not sure about other people, because this is a very, very, very new field. The way I had thought about, so I should say, this prototype task I had was this ice cream flavor mixing. I mentioned that we have four total questions. I ran, so this was like a student project, because I was, I had a student intern last year from data science in France. So he was helping me calculate the metrics, and we were brainstorming how we could do this, because I was working on this creativity game in which we had to look at very much similar types of metrics, even though the creativity game, you know, had a portion where people were, people had 10 squares they had to put together to, for example, make shapes that look like dogs. And then we were rating, okay, this person made 10 dog shapes. How do we know how creative this person was based on the dogs they made? So it's the similar kind of question as, this person came up with 10 different chocolate ice cream pairings. How creative are these? So we looked at the most, I should say, the most straightforward and easy and probably therefore common way of measuring creativity in this case is just how many answers they come up with. You know, how many dogs they made, how many different chocolate ice cream flavors. Of course, those, it's, you know, it maybe people just type very similar things. You know, you can name all the foods. Maybe they type fast. Maybe they just have a big vocabulary. So just the number of answers, which called this is called fluency, that might not be the best way. Another way is to think about how original the answers are. So if I say chocolate and strawberry, you know, how good is this answer by itself? And we can do this either by, you know, I asked 200 people to do this task. So out of the 200 people, how many other people also said strawberry? I can kind of bootstrap it, right? We also made a web-based metric. So with chocolate and strawberry, and this is where the data science student was very helpful, we you know, if you do a Google search for chocolate and strawberry ice cream, you can see how many hits you get. And this is like a inverse measure of originality. We also looked at Google Trends. So how many people do searches for chocolate and strawberry ice cream? So these are things that we use to kind of measure the originality of the idea. Another way to look at creativity is not just look at chocolate and strawberry ice cream, for example, but you look at, for one person, the whole range of answers they give. So if they had 10 different flavors, how wide-ranging are these flavors? Are they all fruits? Are they all nuts? Or do you get like a mix of things? So we tried things like putting them into categories, you know, fruits, nuts. Of course, how you make the categories is its own question. We even looked into chemical compounds. So we used FlavorDB to look up the chemical composition of, say, strawberry or, you know, caramel. Of course, this is an approximation. And then we literally looked at, okay, give a person's answers, how much overlap did they have in chemical compounds and how different they were. So we tried that approach, and then we looked at the classic method of looking at semantic distance. So in a given language model, how different in this language space are, say, strawberry from caramel, from nuts. So we had these different measures of what we call flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
This is how wide ranging your answers are. And the last method I mentioned is semantic distance. This is the same way that modern, I would say, divergent thinking tasks are being measured. Is if you have three different uses for, say, a cup, what you can do is take those three uses and see how different they are in this language model. So how often are they used together? How often they're used separately? So we can do the same thing with flavors. So how often in, you know, all the language corpus of the internet, for example, do people mention chocolate and strawberry ice cream versus chocolate and cinnamon or chocolate and cardamom? So these were kind of initial stabs at metrics. What we couldn't get to last summer, and which what I think is very interesting, is to rate how appropriate are these flavor combinations. Because I can say that chocolate and car, there, it's a very novel, very flexible. I would get very high hits on everything. But it's really appropriate. So we didn't have a test for that. And we also don't have a measure for pleasantness. So how delicious it would be. And these are things which last summer, so the summer of 2022, we thought, okay, we need to get some people to rate this. And when I was presenting this at ECRO, I was thinking, you know, we could potentially ask ChatGPT to here are some flavors, rate the appropriateness and pleasantness of these flavor combinations. Of course, it might answer from a very Euro-Anglo-centric perspective. But it could be a start. It could also be useful to recruit some people online to make judgments. But I should preface this by saying, if I ask you to think about like the chocolate and roast pork ice cream, it's one thing to think about it. And I think that different people have different imagery abilities to think about these combinations of flavors. I think that people who work with food or are interested in food are probably better at this imagery exercise. But it's one thing to imagine the compatibility of the flavors and the deliciousness. And it's another thing to actually taste it. Because sometimes...
So this is still needs to be done. It's still in the future. It's an ongoing project.
I would love to do a study where, you know, we ask, I don't know, 500 people to do this chocolate ice cream task. We get the flavors. We can have ChatGPT rated. We can have some people rate just on paper the ideas. And then we can also make the ice creams and have some people rate the actual flavors. And then you can see, for example, how good is ChatGPT at predicting the flavors? And can we train a machine learning algorithm on like the real people's answers to these flavors and to make it better?
I mean, that would help agencies and producers when they need to change their recipes for certain foods. And they usually have somebody, some food designer who comes up with an idea, but why not use the tool of ChatGPT or another artificial intelligence tool to help with the ingredients?
I think it can help with the inspiration. And also, I know with my friends in perfumery that often you're constrained by budget limits or ingredient availabilities. So I think here is really where machine learning shines, because you can give it constraints and then it becomes an optimization problem of how can you best meet the availability and budget and still have it, you know, kind of smell like something. And then you can give the perfumer like 10 different options. And then maybe the perfumer still has to make the different formulas and smell them and... So I think there's still a human element.
So now we have been talking about how to use creativity to come up with new food pairing. But does it also the other work around? Like you eat, smell, taste something, and then you become more creative. I would like to refer to one publication I just read by Thomas Hummel. He did olfactory training, and to my surprise, they did not only get better in the sense of smell, but also in verbal fluency, just by training with smells. So you were talking about perfumery. Can smells help us to become more creative?
I would love to find this out because I have written several grant proposals, also with Thomas, where we also include creativity tests as a potential, mm-hmm. you know, outcome. I wonder if in the study you saw whether they also had a control group.
I don't totally remember, but when it's with Thomas Hummel, yeah. I would really expect there was a control group.
The reason why I ask is because, you know, you also get better at these tests just by mm-hmm. doing them more, right? So if you have before and after, if people are familiar with the tests, it might be easier. And also verbal fluency is a measure of how many things mm-hmm. you can come up with, which I think is very prone to, let's say, mm-hmm. practice effects. So the more you practice, the more you might come up with more flavors. But regardless, this is kind of touching on a theoretical question. I mean, like, you know, what is creativity and how modality specific mm-hmm. is it? And how domain specific is it? These are kind of open questions. I really believe. So when I wrote the creativity review paper on Can Eating Make Us Creative, I should say that the reason why we made the paper was because we hoped this would give us better coffee. Because the coffee where I worked at the time was like tremendously bad, like so bad, and we really wanted to make this paper to show that, hey, drinking higher quality, more complex coffee mm-hmm. would induce enhanced creativity. So, you know, that was actually, to be honest, the starting point, because we were thinking, okay, so exposure to more complexity in flavors, you would also think about smells, and this might, you know, help with the whole remote association network in the brain, so that you might make connections where you wouldn't make before. It would help you make more metaphors. So I think it could be possible that just being exposed to more smells might help with some mental mm-hmm. processes, you know, such as making associations. I wonder if smell training also helps with memory, because working memory is one of the very key factors behind creativity mm-hmm. performance. So there's all sorts of possibilities where smell mm-hmm, can fit in.
But not yet well researched. So what is about food? What is about coffee, about sweets, about alcohol? Does it make us more creative?
It depends on how you measure creativity. And also who's asking. Because I'm... you know, there's the whole, let's say, stereotype that poets and writers, you know, they need mm-hmm. they need to get drunk or some other sort of psychedelics to, you know, to be creative. I don't think anyone has ever shown that. The two studies I have seen on beer consumption didn't show an influence, but it was also a very measured study with a very small amount of beer, so. I would be very curious whether it's the alcohol or whether it's the knowledge that you're drinking alcohol. This, you know, because we believe that drinking will make us more mm-hmm. creative. So if I think I'm drinking, like, it's the cognitive knowledge rather than the physiological effect, maybe. Of course, alcohol will reduce inhibitions. So maybe what it does is that... when you think about there's divergent thinking and convergent thinking, and convergent thinking is the kind of evaluation part. That's when I come up with chocolate ice cream flavors. That's the part of the brain that says, okay, is this tasty together? Should I include it, yes or no? So maybe what alcohol does is that it loosens that evaluation part, so I will be like, yes, of course, you know, chocolate and seaweed, yes, delicious, chocolate and everything will be good. So by loosening inhibitions, mm-hmm. that might help us become more creative in that sense.
But you are also a wine taster. Does that work for you? Feel like you are more creative after tasting wine? Maybe you're not getting drunk because you do really serious testing and you...
Well, I spit, but I will say this. Every time I taste a wine, I write a tasting note. And I think the process of writing a tasting note is one of the most creative activities. Because it depends on how you write the tasting note. You can do it in the very, let's say, straightforward bread and butter, education way, which is you write down what source ingredients it smells like, and then you write down, okay, what is the alcohol level, low, medium, or high? What is the, actually for alcohol, I would say the percentage. What is the acidity level? What is the body? It's like very cut and dry evaluation. But often what is more fun to do and more evocative is to really think about what kind of metaphors can I use to describe this wine? Like, I can say, okay, this has high acidity, that's great. Or I can say, this has high acidity that slowly builds up in the mouth and then it gets broader, versus this other wine, which is also high acidity, but the acid stays very focused and narrow, and it's very bright or steely, and then it just kind of goes on the same track. So in this way, I really have to be creative to think of ways to describe the experience, this very rich multisensory experience.
So it's like a training, so, like a creativity training for you when you...
I think so. So I actually, oh my God, I would love to do this study. I think people who go through the Master of Wine program end up being more creative, because in the Master of Wine program, when you're describing a wine, it's not enough to say it's high acid or it's 15% alcohol. They really make you come up with vocabulary and descriptors to more precisely describe this experience. I think this is like creativity training.
You just passed the exam, and I saw that. Stage 2 of the Masters of Wine. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And I saw that you had to rate some Prosecco from Venezia, I think. Do you still remember what you wrote about it?
No, because it's 4 days of exams. I did count. It's 23 hours of actually just exams.
Okay.
I was there from 9 to 5 for 4 days, and it's 36 wines, so 3 tasting papers, but also 5 theory papers with essays. So by the end, I remember nothing. I just remembered how horrific an experience it was.
Mm-hmm. And so for the average person who maybe is not into wine or doesn't want to spend all the money on good wines, would there also be a way to train creativity by choosing certain foods?
It's not limited to wine. It's just that wine has quite a long history of people writing about it with tasting notes, etc. You can do this with tea, you can do this with coffee, chocolates. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Maybe tea would be a good way, because there are so many varieties now that you can really do your tea tasting instead of wine tasting, and practice. Maybe write down what you taste and smell.
Exactly. We used to, in the lab, do coffee blind tastings. Mm-hmm. It's very similar. There's actually a lot in common between wine and tea and coffee, or beer, or even juice. One of my friends will do blind tastings of juice for his children, and they love it. He'll pour the different juice into like black glasses so you can't use the color, and the kids really loved making guesses based on the smell and the taste. So I think we can make this fun with most foods.
And is there a research project you are involved in right now, or you're planning to investigate chemosensory creativity?
So what I'm doing right now is, I mentioned that I had this prototype assessment, and I had 200 people do the assessment last year. It was an online task. They did my prototype flavor creativity test. They also did a standard AUT test, and they did a standard like creative self-assessment and openness. So we had a whole slew of creativity assessments. I would like to, actually, I would really like to submit an abstract for Central Metrics. using these natural language processing techniques to make, because I never published anything from the student project because I moved universities and stuff. But I would love to do something at first for Central Metrics, and then maybe write a paper about this, just to describe what are the different techniques we used for this kind of flavor creativity assessment, and how predictive is it of people's creative personality traits, etc. And then how does it compare with the standard language-based one? So that would be fun. And I would love to be able to do some sort of like real life testing.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the kind of thing that could be good for like a big food festival, for example.
Yeah. Or a conference or an ESN meeting. So let's see. If some of our listeners, maybe students in food or sensory science, are interested in the topic of chemosensory creativity, which kind of open and pressing research questions would you like to see them investigating?
I think everything.
Everything. Okay, there are so many open questions.
Like I said, there. So right now, what there is research on, and even that is limited, is the creativity process of chefs,
mm-hmm.
or gastronomy. So very kind of product oriented. You know, why are chefs? What underlies the creativity of chefs, and what does it mean? But what there doesn't really exist, and what I really care about, is like this, what's called little C, everyday creativity. So how do we measure the culinary, I mean, this is not even culinary, it's just smell and taste. You know, it doesn't have to be cooking. I think combining aromas is also counts, right? How do we measure people's creative ability in these areas? Nobody knows. So it's, you know, it's a long-standing question of, you know, is creative potential modality specific or is it general? If I'm kind of, no, say if I didn't have any, say, artistic training or musical training or cooking training or anything, but maybe I'm very good at making dog shapes or like, you know, it could be that I'm good, if I'm making good at kind of generating dog shapes, I'm also good at creating different flavor pairings, or I'm not. But because we don't know how to assess it, we don't even think about it, we don't try to foster these kind of skills.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it would be actually interesting to see a study that see if maybe verbal creativity translates to chemosensory creativity, or if this is totally different.
Mm-hmm.
That one person can be very verbally creative and not creative at all in the food area.
Exactly. And this is something we're trying to... This is something we can start to look at with this prototype thing I developed. I did ask people to do the AUT task along with...
My personal opinion would be no, just because I'm not such a good cook. in the verbal area, I can do creative stuff.
But I don't think you have to be good at cooking, because I can ask... Then, you know, I said chocolate ice cream, but it could equally work if I ask, okay, can you come up with like a air freshener smell on the base of rose, right? Rose plus X.
Could work, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people get scared when they think about cooking, like, oh, you have to make food. But just like the visually based, like the Torrens test of creative thinking, it starts with a circle and you just have to draw something. You don't have to be a great artist. So I think the beauty of these tests is that it should be so simple that you don't have to have domain-specific skills. You need to write and you also have to edit.
So. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So to my last question, you mentioned that you just did the Masters of Wine exam, and I read that you have to do a research paper for stage 3.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
This is so demanding. So do you know what you will be writing about?
This is why there's so few people. more people have been to space than have the Master of Wine.
Okay.
That's a fun quote. So the thing is, I'm actually not allowed to say
what
my research paper is.
But could you say it after you have written it? Or will that
be a
secret forever?
No. So, and this is something I have just learned. While you're doing the project, you have to keep it anonymous. So, like, we're not allowed to say anything on social media, for example.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And this is because when it is graded by unknown examiners, they cannot know who did the research.
The last question is about wine and creativity. Do you have a recommendation for a wine or maybe a type of wine that our listeners could drink to come in a more creative mood?
There are multiple ways to answer this question. Let's start with the more straightforward one. Based on the review paper that I wrote on how eating can make us more creative, something all the studies had in common was that being in a pleasant mood that is also and also being relaxed, so kind of being happy and relaxed, these are the two things that will promote creativity. I would say drinking wine that you like in a small quantity will both make you relaxed and put you in a better mood. Hence,
okay, so
that's the
easy. More a context recommendation than a wine recommendation.
Exactly. In terms of a wine recommendation, what I believe is that tasting something that's very complex might help with boosting creativity, because you have a lot more things to think about and make connections, because mm-hmm. wine will. So I really like old. I just like old wine.
because it's more complex in general.
Exactly. Huh? Especially old sparkling wines and old dessert wines. I just love. Because you get fresh fruit and this nutty dried fruit character, and usually some, say, herbs or earthy notes or more leather, etc. It's a lot of different categories. So you're tasting something that encompasses many different, it's a very high flexibility beverage, because mm-hmm. it covers so many different areas. And if you also challenge yourself to describe it in a more creative way, that act of description will also make us more creative. Because believe it or not, one of the studies that I included in my review paper was a study where people read either a very boring description of a kitchen appliance, or they read a piece of poetry, and reading poems enhanced creativity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in the same way, if you write a tasting note and challenge yourself to make metaphors about the drinking process, that will probably also make you more creative.
Okay, so dear listeners, try it out. Let us know on social media with the hashtag chemosensory creativity what you came up with, and if it really made you more creative, in your opinion. And I have asked all my questions. Is there anything I haven't asked or something that you would like to mention?
I'm sure this has come across very clearly, but this field is very, very new. It's full of unanswered questions. We actually know very little. And I also think it's a very rich field, but it's also very difficult, because something I haven't talked really about is creativity also is bound to, context. In historical or cultural context, mm-hmm. And even different languages. If I do this creativity task in French or English, or depending on the people, the same combination might be viewed very differently by depending on which mm-hmm. culture you're coming from. So it's actually much more difficult than just drawing something into a circle.
Thank you very much for the interview and for your time. I'm looking forward to your next research and research papers. And have a nice evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast was brought to you by the European Sensory Network in 2023. The intro music was by Jackie Brown and is licensed under the Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. And you can listen to more of his music on freemusicarchive.org.